Chapter 20 Action Man. The only power plant that heated the town of Pikaleva shut off its furnaces on May 15, 2009. The owner of the plant had fallen in arrears to Gazprom on the order of $4.5 million, and in Putin's Russia, Gazprom's accounts always took precedence. Pikaleva, with 22,000 people, was a monotown, established in 1957 east of Petersburg, with a single enterprise that serviced the Soviet command economy. It consisted of three interlocking factories that made cement, potash, and alumina, a chemical compound used in the smelting of aluminum. The town's entire livelihood, in Soviet times as now, depended on the factories. Only now, the factories had been privatized into three separate companies that were struggling even before the crisis hit in September. Crippled by the legacy of central planning and a convoluted dispute over prices in the wake of the global turmoil, production in Pikaleva was no longer economically viable. The cement factory went first, closing in October 2008, and laying off hundreds of workers. The potash plant shut down in February, followed in May by the alumina factory, which also owned the power plant. Most of the three factories' 4,500 workers were forced onto unpaid leave or let go. The governor of the region, still known as Leningrad, for it had not changed its name as the city had, appealed to Dmitry Medvedev to negotiate a resolution as early as February, but nothing happened. The shuttering of the power plant turned simmering discontent into a revolt, and the town's residents took to the streets. The governor dismissed the protests, saying that the town's unions were merely fomenting a crisis. Every city shut off the hot water for periods of maintenance, he explained, as if it were a temporary inconvenience. As for the heat, well, I don't think it's needed so much during the summer. On May 20th, several hundred residents stormed an emergency meeting at the mayor's office, demanding not only their hot water, but also their jobs and unpaid salaries. The town's officials, though, had no more power over the factories than the residents did. Their owners were distant tycoons whose financial problems were far greater than the hardship of one remote town in the north. They included one of the country's richest men, Alek Deripaska, an oligarch who had survived the end of the Yeltsin era and now enjoyed a favored status in Putin's. When the storming of the mayor's office failed to resolve anything, residents took their protest to the two-lane federal highway running from Vologda to Novaya Ladoga, near Petersburg, blocking the road for several hours and creating a traffic jam said to extend for 250 miles. The protest was only one of many that had swept the country, from Baikalsk, where workers staged a hunger strike over unpaid wages at a paper mill, to Vladivostok, where protests erupted after new tariffs on automobile imports decimated the sales of used cars from Japan. The Kremlin monitored signs of discontent attentively. Medvedev and his top aides installed a program to track the unrest on their computers, showing troubled regions according to a matrix of measures that included, tellingly, the popularity of the new prime minister. Pikaleva was no worse off than the other struggling cities, but the spiraling protests there became so pronounced that they forced Putin to act, or perhaps were singled out to make the point that he would, if necessary. On June 4th, Putin went to Pikaleva and summoned the owners of the shuttered factories to meet him there for a public dressing down that even by his standards was impressively abrasive. "Why didn't you fix this before?" he scolded them when he met them in full view of the Kremlin's pool of television cameras. "You ran around like cockroaches when I said I was coming." Outside, hundreds of residents surrounded the factory where the meeting took place, waiting in the rain for word of what seemed like divine intervention. Putin, wearing a gray raincoat and a shirt unbuttoned at the neck, slouched at the table, seething with contempt. "You have taken these people hostage with your ambition, unprofessionalism, and maybe simple greed. Thousands of people. It's absolutely unacceptable." He gestured with a short stack of papers, an agreement already completed in advance of his arrival. Had everyone signed it? He stared at the unshaven Deripaska, whose fortunes had been battered by the economic crisis. Someone answered yes, but Deripaska nodded confusedly. There was really no document that needed a signature, but Putin summoned him to the front of the room anyway, humiliating him before everyone, most importantly, the television viewers who would turn on the news that night and marvel at the force of the Prime Minister's will. Putin tossed his pen on the papers. Deripaska picked it up and made a pretense of skimming through the text before scribbling his signature. As he turned away, Putin cut him one bit lower. "And give me back my pen." Outside, the workers began to receive text messages on their telephones. They came from their banks. Their unpaid salaries, more than $1 million, would be deposited by the end of the day. Putin had made sure of that. For months before, Putin had appeared increasingly detached. He worked more often at the residence at Novoagareva than in his newly refurbished office in the government building, the White House. He delegated the day-to-day running of the government to one of his deputies, Igor Shevalov. The drafting of a new state budget dragged on for months while bureaucrats awaited decisions that he appeared to be in no rush to make. With the performance in Pikaleva, however, he woke to the political threat of the economic crisis and the prescription for salving it. On the very day Putin swept through Pikaleva, Medvedev warned that while the worst of the crisis had passed, it was not yet time to open the champagne. But it was Putin who knew when a little succor was what the people needed. The spectacle showed that Putin had no desire to release the levers of control, not to Medvedev, and certainly not to people massed in the street. Putin's scolding of the plant owners had been harsh, but he also made it clear that he would not allow the rabble to establish a precedent for the airing of grievances against the government. Deripaska understood the charade and accepted his public humiliation because he knew it was the cost of his privileged status in the Kremlin elite. He did not even come out the worst in the deal to restart the factories. The main supplier of the material the factory in Pikaleva needed, Nepheline, was forced to sell it at a loss. Putin brokered even the details of its supply, delivered by Russian railways, headed by Putin's old comrade from Petersburg, Vladimir Yakunin. The supplier, Foss Agro, would soon expand its holdings to include the fertilizer plant that Mikhail Khodorkovsky had been accused of pilfering, Apatit. One of its newest shareholders was the man who had approved Putin's disputed thesis in 1997, Vladimir Litvinenko. The agreement to reopen Pikaleva did nothing to solve the underlying problem with production there, nor the lack of demand for aluminum, which was compounded by the economic crisis. But that was not the point. Deripaska had already received billions in credits to help restructure his crippling debt, and even an extra loan to keep production open in Pikaleva. The public dressing down, nevertheless, warned other tycoons that they should resolve any crises that could foment public unrest before Putin was forced to add new stops on his angry itinerary. Instead of using the economic crisis as an opportunity to address underlying weaknesses in the country's economy, which Medvedev would spell out in an online manifesto in September called Russia Forward, Putin intensified his role as the ultimate dispenser of the country's resources, punishing those who resisted his vision of how the money should be spent, and rewarding those who went along. When the government established a mechanism for distributing funds from the stimulus package in 2009, Putin unilaterally decided which companies would receive them. This was how business worked in Putin's mind, through connections and deals, not through a liberalized economy where the market would make the decisions. Putin's personal control of economic policy caused confusion at times. Even as he swaggered through Pikaleva in May, the Kremlin's economic advisers were putting the final touches on an agreement with the United States to advance Russia's stalled bid to join the World Trade Organization. Putin himself had criticized Russia's exclusion from the WTO, and the talks had made progress. But only days later, he unexpectedly announced that Russia would instead pursue an economic alliance with Belarus and Kazakhstan and only joined the WTO with them as a bloc. The reversal made little sense economically, since Russia had far more foreign trade with Europe and the United States than with others. Linking Russia's bid to a trade bloc that had not even been established would delay membership indefinitely. It also revealed the divisions within the Kremlin. Alexei Kudrin, still the finance minister in Putin's cabinet, tried three times to talk Putin out of the announcement that week, but neither he nor Medvedev could prevail. Instead of opening up Russia's economy in response to the global crisis, Putin gave in to populist and autarkic instincts, cheered on by the hardliners who believed that the vagaries of the global market could be, and were being, manipulated to punish Russia. He did so because he believed he had chosen the wiser path to recovery. The economic crisis had been ruinous for Russia, but the Kremlin's emergency measures had managed to avert total collapse. By the middle of 2009, the price of oil had risen again, easing some of the pressures on the budget. The ruble regained some of its value, and the stock market began to recoup its losses. By 2010, Russia's economy was growing, bouncing back, in fact, with far more vigor than the economies of Europe and the United States. Far from encouraging a fuller embrace of economic modernization, the crisis only convinced Putin that Russia's economic security lay in the system of control that he had created, and in the power of his will. The dire predictions that Putin's system and Putin himself could not survive the economic and political tumult proved to be greatly exaggerated. On September 28, 2009, the chief executive of Gazprom, Alexei Miller, joined local and regional officials on a hill overlooking the Imereti Valley south of Sochi, the wide fluvial plain that Putin had approved as one of two main sites for the Winter Games, then less than 5 years away. They were there to break ground on a new power plant, which, when finished, would become the most visible structure on the coastal cityscape, topped with the company's logo. The necessity of building a power plant underscored just how underdeveloped the region had become. Beloved by Soviet leaders, especially Stalin, who built a dacha there, the resorts had fallen into disrepair even before the collapse of the Soviet Union. With prosperity trickling down to a burgeoning consumer class, millions and millions of Russians were lured instead by inexpensive vacation packages to Thailand, Turkey, and the Sinai, and Sochi became a backwater, left behind and often in the dark. Having won the Olympics, Putin was determined to return Sochi to its previous glory, the Sochi he remembered from his first visits as a young man in the 1970s. The economic crisis had done nothing to smother those ambitions. In fact, they were an answer to it. With Sochi, he was reviving the legacy of the Soviet megaproject, the gigantic top-down endeavors that industrialized the Soviet Union. These were the ideological triumphs of Putin's historical memory, from the Virgin Lands campaign to boost agricultural output in the 1950s, to the Baikal-Amur mainline, or BAM, in the 1970s. As in Soviet times, the goal was ideological as much as economic, a demonstration of the country's progress and prestige in the world, even as the projects consumed enormous resources. Sochi became the largest single infrastructure project since the Soviet Union collapsed, though it was not the only one. Putin approved $20 billion to develop Vladivostok in the Far East, including a university on an island in the harbor that had been a closed military zone, and a suspension bridge linking it to the city, in preparation for a two-day summit in 2012 of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Nations. He spent $7 billion to rebuild much of Kazan to hold the 2013 Universiada, a biennial competition that hardly ranked as a major international event, but justified an expensive redevelopment plan of the city. Flush from securing the Olympics, Putin drafted a bid to host the World Cup in 2018, promising to build or renovate stadiums in 12 cities, including the one in Kazan that would be used for the Universiade and the one in Sochi that would be the site of the opening and closing ceremonies in 2014. Each of these projects served multiple purposes for Putin, advertising Russia as a great power, providing economic stimulus to a faltering economy, and dispensing the resources of the state to those in a position to profit most. Putin's attention to Sochi became so obsessive during his term as prime minister that the Olympics were called his pet project. It was not only a manifestation of his power, but also an instrument for keeping it. He had appointed one of his closest and most trusted advisors, Dmitry Kozak, to manage the project, and he created a new state company, Olympstry, to build the venues that Sochi needed. By decree, Putin suspended legal and legislative oversight of the construction, including questions of cost and the environmental impact in an area that UNESCO had designated for protected status as one of the only large mountain area in Europe that has not experienced significant human impact. He also maintained formal control over the distribution of the contracts awarded to build the Olympic venues. He sat on the supervisory board of the state development agency, Veneshekonombank, which would end up providing the credits for the vast majority of the projects, whose contractors were also decided on by Putin. At Gazprom's groundbreaking ceremony, little was said about the companies that would build the plant or the pipeline, and nothing about the men who owned them. The contractor commissioned to build the pipeline was called Stroygaz Montaj, which had not even existed until the year before. The company had emerged from the economic crisis in 2008, snatching up, for $400 million, various Gazprom subsidiaries and subcontractors that had built the country's vast network of pipelines. The man behind Stroygaz Montaj happened to be Putin's judo sparring partner from his youth, Arkady Rotenberg. By now, Rotenberg had parlayed his role in the state vodka monopoly, Rospiriprom, into a fortune. One of his factories even produced a new brand, Putinka, a playful diminutive on Putin's name, which soon became one of the most popular and lucrative brands in Russia. Rotenberg's entry into the pipeline business made him wealthy on a whole new scale. Soon, many of Gazprom's expansion projects went to his company, from the construction of Nord Stream, the pipeline that had entangled Gerhard Schroeder in scandal, to the pipeline that would provide heat to the new island complex Putin was erecting in Vladivostok. In 2010, Rotenberg and his brother Boris occupied the final two spots on Forbes' list of the 100 richest Russians, worth $700 million each. Arkady Rotenberg was so reclusive that he did not give an interview until his appearance among Russia's wealthiest began to raise speculation about the remarkable source of his wealth. "We didn't just come off the streets," he acknowledged in an interview with Kommersant. Putin's mega projects only propelled Rotenberg's rise. In 2010, with his son, he took over the company building the power plant above the future Olympic Village and received contract after contract for the Games, 21 in all, worth nearly $7 billion, an amount equivalent to the entire cost of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. He did not deny that his friendship with Putin had helped his meteoric rise, but he described their relationship as a duty, a burden, and as their judo coach had said, a matter of trust. Knowing government officials of that high a level hasn't hurt anyone, but it certainly hasn't helped everyone either, he told the newspaper. It's not a guarantee. I repeat, Putin has many more friends than those who are today famous and successful. Moreover, everyone for some reason forgets about the huge responsibility of such a friendship. For me, it is especially a responsibility. I try to behave in a way that I would never betray him. As Putin's government parceled out contracts without public tenders and public scrutiny, the overwhelming majority went to those, like Rotenberg, whom Putin had elevated. Russian Railways, headed by Vladimir Yakunin, oversaw the single largest and ultimately most expensive project, the railroad spur that connected the coast to the mountains, where the skiing events would be held. The project, called the Combined Road, was at once an engineering marvel that overcame enormous geological challenges and, to critics, a boondoggle that created an environmental calamity in a once largely undisturbed valley. The railroad courses up the left bank of the Muzimta River, named after the word for wild in the lost Ubuk language that was spoken in the mountains before the Russian Empire conquered the region in the 19th century. The highway ran parallel to it and an old two-lane road on the right bank. The river gorge is so narrow in places that nearly 24 of the railroad's 30 miles had to run through tunnels, 12 in all, including one nearly 3 miles long, or over bridges, hundreds of piers of which were driven into the river or its banks, irreparably altering its wild state. Environmentalists mounted a campaign to challenge the project, but Putin had also suspended the laws that would have normally blocked the work. Environmentalists who protested were harassed and ultimately jailed. Russian railways subcontracted much of the work to companies that were also linked to Putin's friends, including the bridge builder SK Most. A majority share of that company was subsequently purchased by Gennady Timchenko. From the start, the Olympic construction was bedeviled by delays and soon by spiraling costs, forcing Putin to intervene, at times forcefully, to keep the project moving forward. 3 times Putin fired the directors of Alimstrai, ostensibly because he was frustrated by slow progress and cost overruns. The priority Putin placed on the Games invited the huge cost overruns. It had become so urgent a priority that no expense was spared, and much was skimmed off the top. Because the allocation of contracts was so opaque, there was little accountability. A 2009 effort by the communists in the Duma to impose oversight over the spiraling costs was blocked by United Russia. There was ample evidence of corruption, with huge kickbacks factored into the contracts. But despite publicly chiding officials about the costs and dangers of corruption, Putin did nothing to punish it, even when it was exposed. In 2009, a Moscow businessman, Valery Morozov, complained publicly that an official in the Kremlin's Office of Presidential Affairs, Vladimir Leshchevsky, had shaken him down for 12% of a $500 million contract to refurbish a government-owned sanatorium in Sochi. He paid either in cash or through payments to an offshore company, but when he felt he was being squeezed out of the deal, he went to the police, who arranged a sting at Slivovitsa, a beer restaurant not far from the Kremlin. He even wore a hidden camera in his belt to record the last cash installment of $5 million. Leshchevsky took the cash but slipped away without being arrested. Frustrated by the failed sting, Morozov went public, appealing directly to Dmitry Medvedev's office and indirectly through the British and Russian press. Medvedev announced an investigation, but it quietly died 2 years later. Instead, prosecutors opened an investigation into Morozov's company. Morozov fled to Britain and detailed his accusations in a lengthy application for political asylum, which he received. The lesson was clear for anyone who dared challenge the system. One man who did, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a cell in the Matroskaya Tishina prison in Moscow on November 16, 2009. He had been transferred there for emergency medical treatment for pancreatitis and cholecystitis. He had already been in prison for nearly a year, the maximum he could be held without trial, on charges involving a massive tax fraud that he had uncovered and reported to the authorities. Instead of taking the ailing man to the prison's hospital, 8 guards took him to an isolation cell, handcuffed him, and beat him with batons. He was only 37, an auditor so unprepossessing that no one would mistake him for a radical threatening Putin's system. He represented the post-Soviet generation that had come of age in the new Russia, highly educated and professional, a father of two, who believed in the dictatorship of law that Putin promised, as well as the end of legal nihilism that Medvedev had. After his arrest in 2008, he was sure the law would ultimately protect him. Instead, he spent week after week transferred from dirty cell to dirty cell, allowed to see his wife and mother only once while in detention. He kept a meticulous diary of the abuses he experienced, as well as the steady decline of his health. To pass time, he read Shakespeare's tragedies. His treatment in prison, and finally his death, might have been soon forgotten, as had so many others in Russia's horrid judicial system, where 5,000 prisoners died that year. But Magnitsky had worked for a powerful patron, William Browder, once the country's most prominent foreign investor. Browder had been an early cheerleader for Putin's presidency, believing in the economic reforms he pledged, but by then, he had become one of its most embittered foes. Browder had amassed a fortune investing in shares in Russian companies, and then using those shareholder stakes to lobby for good corporate governance and transparency. He was brash and aggressive, often suing companies, and though he almost always lost in court, he felt he shared a common goal with Putin to make Russia a truly competitive economy after the corrupted oligarchy of the 1990s. In 2005, however, he was unexpectedly turned away at the airport in Moscow, his visa revoked as a matter of national security. Browder's aggressive investment strategy had crossed some line, perhaps involving Gazprom or Surgut Neftegaz, both with close links to Putin, but he would never know which one for certain. He initially hoped his deportation was a mistake that would be promptly sorted out. He appealed to the men he believed were his allies in the Kremlin, but by 2007, prosecutors had turned their attention to his company's offices in Moscow, and Browder began quietly divesting the assets of his investment fund, Hermitage Capital, and moving them to London. That June, 24 officers from the Interior Ministry raided Hermitage's skeletal office in Moscow and seized the company's corporate records, the certificates and stamps for the holding companies that had made up its portfolio. By the end of the year, three of the companies had been mysteriously re-registered under new owners, all of them convicted criminals. These owners then applied for $230 million in tax refunds, which were granted on a single day in December. Browder turned to a law firm in Moscow, Firestone Duncan, to figure out what had happened. The accountant who untangled the convoluted scheme was Sergei Magnitsky. He testified before the state's investigative committee, identifying the Interior Ministry officers, judges, and tax inspectors who had orchestrated the elaborate theft of the company's seals and the subsequent tax fraud. The ministry ordered an investigation into the theft, and assigned as the lead investigator the major who Magnitsky had accused of orchestrating it, Artyom Kuznetsov. Magnitsky was arrested 18 days later. Magnitsky's death deeply shocked Russia's elite. They had long been inured to the harsh measures used against political activists and wayward businessmen, but Magnitsky was neither. Even if Browder posed a threat to someone's powerful interests, Magnitsky was clearly a collateral victim. His death exposed a sweeping web of abuse and lies about the case he investigated, his arrest and detention, the failure to treat his deteriorating health, the final beating that killed him. Dmitry Medvedev, too, seemed shocked. Few cases illustrated as well the legal nihilism that he believed was stifling Russia's economic future. He ordered the prosecutor general to investigate and formed a working group to review the case independently, appointing prominent rights advocates whom Putin had increasingly marginalized when he was in the Kremlin. In December, Medvedev dismissed 20 officials of the prison service, though most came from faraway regions. Only one had any connection to Magnitsky's treatment in detention. Meanwhile, Browder poured his resources into tracing the proceeds from the $230 million in tax receipts. The lead investigator had purchased two apartments worth more than $2 million, registered in his parents' names, as well as a Mercedes-Benz, a Range Rover, and a Land Rover, each worth many times more than his annual salary of $10,200. The woman in the tax office who had approved the rebates had an estate in Moscow, a seaside villa in Dubai, and $11 million in cash in offshore accounts in her husband's name, according to Browder's investigators. The bureaucrats involved lived so far beyond their official means that it was clear that the embezzlement from Hermitage had been replicated in hundreds, perhaps thousands, of cases. Magnitsky had revealed not just the corrupted acts of a few officials, but the corruption of the entire system. For Medvedev, coming as it did only months after his Russia Forward exhortations, the case could have been an opportunity to set an example by punishing those involved in the embezzlement and the death of an innocent accountant. The official investigation, however, dragged on in silence, even as Browder made the case an international cause célèbre, petitioning the United States Congress and parliaments in Europe to impose sanctions on 60 people who had been involved. On the eve of the first anniversary of Magnitsky's death, the prosecutor's office at last announced the conclusion of its investigation, and it was as Kafkaesque as anything Medvedev had inveighed against. Magnitsky, the prosecutors announced triumphantly, had masterminded the embezzlement he uncovered. It took nearly 2 years for the working group Medvedev had commissioned to present its final report. Its principal authors did so at a meeting with Medvedev in the Kremlin, concluding that his arrest had been unlawful, his death a crime, the investigation a cover-up, and the courts willing collaborators. Medvedev acknowledged in the meeting that crimes had been committed, but he was powerless to do anything about it. The next day, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, ostensibly responsible to him as president and commander-in-chief, dismissed the group's report as irrelevant. Then the prosecutor's office announced that after a thorough investigation, it would reopen the criminal case against Magnitsky and charge him with tax fraud. Not even during the worst show trials of the Great Terror in the 1930s had the authorities put a dead man on trial. They would even call his mother to testify in court. The United States, under President Obama in particular, vested inordinate hope in Dmitry Medvedev's presidency. Seeing his election as an evolutional shift in Russia's political development, Obama promised a reset in relations after the disastrous end to the Bush years. Although realistic about Putin's continued political dominance, Obama and his aides went out of their way to court Medvedev directly, according to protocol, and hoped that he would over time build his own foundations of political power. Putin had one foot in the old way of doing business, Obama said undiplomatically only weeks before he was to meet the new leader and the paramount one. But with Medvedev, he hoped to move into a new era. No one in the White House or the State Department had any illusions that Medvedev could act without Putin's consent on important matters of state, but the initial embrace appeared to produce results. In 2009, the two leaders negotiated a treaty, New START, to replace the agreement Putin had negotiated with George Bush in 2002, and to further reduce the two nations' nuclear arsenals. Medvedev, as Putin had once done, helped the United States in Afghanistan, allowing the Americans to begin withdrawing thousands of materiel, though not weapons, by railroad through Russian territory. When presented with evidence that Iran had developed a secret uranium enrichment program, Russia joined the United States at the United Nations Security Council and voted to impose new sanctions on the Iranian economy. Making his own concession on one of Russia's bêtes noires, Obama abandoned plans to deploy missile defenses in the Czech Republic and Poland, the very deployments that had provoked Putin's ire before his Munich speech in 2007. The Obama administration even played down the American efforts to support democratic change in Ukraine and Georgia, which in neither place had succeeded very well anyway. Georgia remained a close American ally, but a fractured one after the war in 2008. Viktor Yanukovych, whose fraudulent victory in Ukraine in 2004 had been overturned, managed to exploit the infighting of his rivals and defeat Yulia Tymoshenko in an honest election in February 2010, after which she was tried and sent to jail, ironically, for having negotiated a deal with Putin to end a second shutoff of natural gas in the winter of 2009. The reset seemed to be working, but the warming of relations did not extend to Putin himself, and soon other events chilled the warming trend. Only 2 months after Medvedev and Obama signed New START in April 2010, the FBI uncovered the existence of 11 sleeper agents who had lived covertly in the United States throughout Putin's rise to power. They were, in the parlance of espionage, illegals, posing as ordinary suburban Americans, working and raising children near Boston, New York, and Washington, without the protection of diplomatic immunity. As recently as 2009, Russia's FSB reminded these agents, in an encrypted message intercepted by the FBI, to search and develop ties in policy-making circles and sent intels to C. The initial referred to the center, where they sent reports, as well as pleas for reimbursements for the education and housing the agents felt they needed to live the American dream. The FBI informed President Obama on the eve of Medvedev's second official visit to the United States, during which he visited Silicon Valley and promoted foreign investment and trade. But they did not move to make arrests until after Medvedev's meetings at the White House and a chummy lunch with Obama at a popular hamburger restaurant in Arlington, Virginia. Assisted by amused media coverage of what seemed to be a network of ineffective spies enjoying the perquisites of American life, Obama's aides dismissed the espionage as harmless efforts to glean information easily accessible from public sources. But the scope of the effort testified to the intensity of Russia's lingering distrust of American intentions. 10 of the agents pleaded guilty in July. The 11th had fled to Cyprus and apparently escaped back to Russia. The others were traded with Cold War-like drama at the airport in Vienna, exchanged for 4 Russians who had been imprisoned at home for spying for the West, though in at least one case the man insisted he had never been a spy. Upon the sleepers' return, Putin met secretly with them, honoring those who had experienced the secret life he had once imagined for himself as a boy. Together, they sang songs, including the sentimental theme to The Shield and the Sword, the film that in 1968 propelled Putin into the KGB, and even now seemed to serve as the foundation for his increasingly insulated and paranoid worldview. Putin still knew the words, and had learned to play the music on the piano, which he would do at a charity auction a few months later. "Whence does the motherland begin?" the song's lyrics ask, and the answer seemed rooted in Putin's own background. With good and trusted comrades living in the neighboring yard. Putin disclosed their meeting during an official visit in July to Sevastopol, the Crimea port that was the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet. He was attending an international motorcycle rally featuring the Night Wolves, Russia's version of the Hells Angels, bikers who blended patriotism, Russian orthodoxy, and reverence for Putin. He rode with them, though on a 3-wheeled motorcycle especially kitted out for him, the sort of photo opportunity that was again becoming more common. The betrayal of the illegals deeply angered him, and he vowed that the source, who he said was already known, would suffer for it. "Traitors always meet a bad end," he said. "As a rule, they die from either heavy drinking or drug abuse." He then alluded to Sergei Tretyakov, a senior intelligence officer who had defected to the United States in 2000. He was known to his American handlers as Comrade J, and among his disclosures were details about Putin's own chief of security, Viktor Zolotov. Tretyakov died only days before the spy ring was broken up, but his wife kept his death out of the news until the FBI could complete an autopsy, which showed no foul play. Having been head of intelligence activities at the United Nations before his defection, he might well have had a role in exposing the illegals, though his wife denied that. "Actually," Putin said of Tretyakov anyway, "his life was such a waste." The stylistic contrast between Medvedev and Putin prompted endless speculation about actual rifts within their tandem. Given Putin's expectation of loyalty, however, evidence of them rarely surfaced. Publicly, at least, the two men and their aides portrayed their relationship as one united in a shared vision for Russia's future. There cannot be, by definition, any disagreements in the Medvedev-Putin tandem. The Speaker of the State Duma, Boris Gritslov, declared in 2010. At the start of the presidency, the two men had in fact reached an agreement to which few others were privy, respecting the responsibilities of their respective offices, though Putin retained a greater say in military and intelligence matters than any prime minister before him. In the first half of his presidency, Medvedev never directly aired a word of criticism toward Putin himself or his policies, even as he struck a far more liberal tone in speeches that some read as implicit rebukes. Behind the scenes, though, rivalries hardened between the two offices and their cadres, the two centers of power. Medvedev had developed his own camp of advisers at the Kremlin who, like him, bristled at the obstacles that emerged to the president's policies and his vision of a more progressive society and economy. As they learned that Medvedev's authority extended only as far as Putin's forbearance allowed, their resentments became more and more pronounced. "There were disagreements, it is normal," one of Medvedev's closest advisers once said, though refusing to say even that much publicly. In fact, on the issues that mattered most to him, Putin not only retained the ultimate veto, but dictated the details as well. In the eyes of the public, Medvedev became the man of words, Russia forward, while Putin was the man of action. When pernicious peat fires shrouded Moscow and other cities in choking smoke in the summer of 2010, it was Putin who came to the rescue, as he had in Pikalevo. The fires, fueled by a heat wave, burned uncontrolled for weeks, killing dozens of people and destroying entire villages. Medvedev was on vacation on the Black Sea and slow to return even as the disaster worsened. The government seemed helpless to control them, prompting unusually fierce criticism. A blogger's profanity-laced diatribe, published on the website of Echo Moscow, was so incendiary that Putin had to respond. "Where does our money go?" the blogger, who introduced himself as Alexander from a village near Tver, wrote. He complained that the village lost what meager equipment it had to fight the fires encroaching on residents' homes. He then went on to single out one of Medvedev's signature proposals, to create a Silicon Valley-like center for technological innovation in the Moscow suburb of Skolkovo. "Why do we every year slip farther and farther from even a primitive social system? What the fuck is your innovation center in Skolkovo to us if we do not have basic fire trucks?" That the screed criticized a project closely associated with Medvedev's presidency and not Putin himself might have been the only reason it received the attention it did. A diatribe like that against Putin personally would have been too toxic for any media to discuss so openly. But it resonated widely, and Putin was sensitive to shifts in public opinion. 9 days later, he appeared on television piloting an amphibious aircraft to fight the fires personally. The plane landed in the Oka River to load water and later dumped it on a smoldering bog southeast of Moscow. "Was that okay?" Putin asked, turning toward the pilot. "A direct hit," the pilot replied. These images, no matter how transparently staged by the Kremlin's media advisors and pliant television channels, proved remarkably effective. Putin was the ultimate celebrity of the Kremlin's own reality, the indispensable leader, even a glamorous elite sexual icon, whose stunts seemed intended to elicit passionate, even sexualized reactions from women. Medvedev never enjoyed the same adulation, spontaneous or contrived. Where Putin once demurred at displays that suggested a cult of personality, saying manifestations of reverence for the nation's leader were inappropriately redolent of Stalinism, he now seemed to embrace them more than he ever had before. The publicity stunts not only served Putin's politics, they played into his vanity, and he appeared to take his vanity very seriously. Only weeks after his 58th birthday, Putin appeared in public with his face so heavily caked with makeup that journalists noticed. He was in Kyiv, this time for talks to merge Ukraine's airline manufacturer with one of Russia's newly rebuilt state enterprises, the United Aviation Corporation. Ties with Ukraine had improved measurably after the election of Yanukovych in 2010, but Putin seemed uneasy, even avoiding looking at the television cameras. Beneath the makeup, there were visible bruises under his eyes. "It's probably just the way the light fell," his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, insisted. "The Prime Minister is tired." The bruises were undeniable, however, and they prompted speculation that Putin had begun a regime of cosmetic surgery. The speculation, always denied, though never unequivocally, swelled as changes in Putin's appearance became evident in photographs and drew the attention of foreign officials who met him, at least one of whom spoke off the record of the cosmetic work as a matter of fact. The crow's feet on his temples disappeared, as did the deep creases in his forehead and the noticeable bags under his eyes. His skin was taut, his cheeks fuller. With his thinning but carefully groomed hair, his face seemed rounder, his eyes narrower. A plastic surgeon in Chelyabinsk, Alexander Pukov, even came forward to claim he knew the doctor who had carried out the procedures, which included blepharoplasty. He said so approvingly. "Would you really want to see the president old and flabby?" Tensions within the tandem became more pronounced in the summer of 2010 when protests erupted over the construction of a new highway from Moscow to Petersburg. No one doubted the need for better roads, and the project, valued at $8 billion, was among the mega projects Putin approved to stimulate economic growth. But a debate had raged for years over the route. And now, without public notice, the project suddenly moved forward. In July, bulldozers appeared and began clearing trees from Khimki Forest, a protected preserve on the edge of Moscow that many called the lungs of the city. The work prompted protests by the forest neighbors, who were soon joined by local and foreign environmental activists. Wary after the public anger over the summer's fires, Medvedev announced in August that he would suspend the construction while the government considered alternate routes. The controversy became an unexpected test of Medvedev's authority as president, and he failed. Moscow's mayor, Yuri Lushkov, criticized the suspension of the project in the government's official newspaper, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, a public rebuke he had never dared to make against Putin. Lushkov, who had once opposed the highway for his own reasons, had shifted support to it. His reason was evidently that he knew the project had the support of Putin, who had awarded the contract for construction in 2008, and a year later waived the forest's protected status to allow construction to begin. Whether Medvedev knew that was never clear. But he acted as if he had the power to intervene now. Lushkov, who had presided over Moscow for 18 years, defiantly called for a restoration of the true meaning and authority of the government. Many heard those words as a call for Putin to return to the presidency, a provocation that Medvedev could hardly ignore. His aides in the Kremlin responded by unleashing state television on the mayor as fiercely as Boris Yeltsin's had more than a decade before, when Lushkov and Primakov appeared poised to emerge as the leaders of a post-Yeltsin coalition. After a week of that, Medvedev's chief of staff summoned Lushkov and asked him to resign and leave quietly. When he refused, the Kremlin told him to go on holiday for a week to think it over. Medvedev, who privately denounced Lushkov with an earthy vulgarity for loudmouth that roughly translates as "one who rings his balls," appeared unable to act without Putin's approval. Opposition leaders like Boris Nemtsov all but dared Medvedev to demonstrate his authority. But it was only when Lushkov returned to Moscow and wrote a letter to Medvedev mocking his democratic pretensions and demanding the restoration of elections for mayors and governors, which Putin had taken away, that Medvedev finally received approval to dismiss him. 2 weeks later, Putin forced Medvedev to appoint as mayor Putin's chief of staff, Sergei Sobyanin, a former governor from Siberia who had little experience or knowledge of the capital. It seemed that Medvedev had triumphed, demonstrating resolve by removing Lushkov from power, but the confrontation also illustrated the limits of his power as president. The highway construction later went ahead as planned. The main contractor, the only bidder, was owned by a convoluted, overlapping chain of companies registered in Cyprus and the British Virgin Islands. One was called Croisset Investments, half of which was owned by another called Olpan Investments. Its sole owner was Arkady Rotenberg. When Medvedev was pressed on why the government had allowed the work to resume, he could only mutter that there were private interests involved. Medvedev's leadership disappointed Putin's critics, and the constraints on his authority left Medvedev himself frustrated. At the end of 2010, his resentments boiled over for the first time as the fate of Mikhail Khodorkovsky once again hung in the balance. With the end of his first prison sentence approaching, the authorities had launched a new investigation against Khodorkovsky and his partner, Platon Lebedev, intended to keep them in prison. The second trial had begun in 2009, this time on charges of embezzling profits that amounted to more than the worth of the oil Yukos had extracted over a period of 6 years. It had dragged on for 19 months. Resigned to a guilty verdict, Khodorkovsky's lawyers sought to highlight the political motives behind the case instead. They called as a witness Putin himself, as well as Igor Sechin, the finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, and 20 other officials. The judge refused, but did allow some prominent officials to testify, hoping, it seemed, to demonstrate some adherence to due process. They included one of Putin's oldest colleagues, German Greff, who appeared rattled by being questioned by Khodorkovsky himself through the glass enclosure where the defendants sat. A crucial moment came when Greff conceded the point that was at the center of Khodorkovsky's defense, that it would have been impossible for him to have stolen what amounted to a year's worth of the entire country's oil production without somebody in the government noticing it at the time. The courts in Russia had become so politicized by then that Khodorkovsky had no hope of prevailing. His defense was simply an exercise in delegitimizing the judicial process, and in that it succeeded. The prosecution was even more convoluted and confused than at his first trial, making a mockery of Medvedev's pledges to end legal nihilism. The proceedings were riddled with procedural errors, conflated or contradictory accusations, and lacked any semblance of fairness. The spectacle was roundly condemned outside of Russia as an indication of the authoritarian state Russia had become. On the eve of the judge's verdict, Putin even intervened forcefully with one of his own. "It is my conviction that a thief should sit in jail," he declared in his annual phone-in appearance on December 16th, alluding to a line from a popular television serial from 1979, "The meeting place cannot be changed." He spoke of Khodorkovsky's previous conviction as though it had already proved his guilt with regard to the new charges, and compared him to the American financier Bernard Madoff, who had recently been sentenced to 150 years for running one of the largest Ponzi schemes in history. Putin's response sounded deeply emotional, full of personal anger and indignation. He went even further than the charges themselves, suggesting that Khodorkovsky had ordered his chief of security to carry out the murder of the mayor of Neftyugansk, where Yukos's main oil fields were located. One woman in Moscow refused to hand over her small property, and they killed her, too. And then they killed the assassin they hired to carry out those killings. All they found was his brains splattered all over his garage. At this point, even Medvedev had to object. For the first time, he openly criticized Putin, saying that no one, not the president, not the prime minister, had a right to pronounce judgment before it was delivered by the court. His admonishment had no effect. In fact, the verdict had already been decided, its 878 pages written for the judge to read, as his own assistant would later disclose, describing recurrent meetings and relentless pressure from senior officials. The trial did more than expose the emptiness of Medvedev's pledges. It signaled an emerging breach between the two that would only worsen, punctuating the end of the tandem and the hopes so many had invested in it. The judge sentenced Khodorkovsky to 13 years in prison, though the term was later reduced slightly. This ensured that, with his time already served, he would remain behind bars until 2016, well past the next parliamentary and presidential elections. Khodorkovsky responded with a series of public and legal appeals, all futile. He taunted Medvedev for his lack of authority and pitied Putin for his vindictiveness. In an open letter in the Nezavisimaya Gazeta, he wrote that Putin was incapable of tearing himself away from the already unmanageable ore of the monstrous galley he himself has built, a galley that apathetically sails right over people's destinies, a galley over which, more and more, the citizens of Russia seem to see a black pirate flag flying.